And now for our keynote. Mr. Havick Pennington is going to be coming up in a moment, and he's going to be sharing with us. But I just wanted to start off by saying, well, you can read his bio there if you want. But let me say this. When we started organising this conference, I thought to myself, who do I really want to come to Adelaide? Who in the open source community hasn't come to a KLU or a LCA? And I really wanted Havick to come. He was like one of the top on my list of the contributors in the community to come. Reason for that is you can look there at some of the things that he's written or been involved in. Metacity, gconf, GNOME Terminal, libwnc, and you know he's leading up the desktop development effort at Red Hat, and them are doing some great stuff on the desktop. And he's courageous as well. I mean, who would try to unify KDE themes and GNOME themes? Who would take that on? Who would turn around to the hacker community and say, no, you don't need a window manager with 13,000 options. You need something that's simple and easy to use. And he convinced us to move to Metacity. This is Havick Pennington. He's a great guy. And the other thing I'll say about him, I have submitted some pretty average bug reports, and he's been really friendly in replying to them. And he didn't tell me that I just haven't got any idea what I'm talking about. He just was very nice in return. So without much further ado, I'd like you to welcome the leader of the desktop integration project at Red Hat, a famous GNOME hacker, and the rock star, Havick Pennington.
I noticed the polite silence when he mentioned Metacity. All right. So, everybody's totally asleep and hungover, I imagine. So I realized last night that that was going to happen, and that in fact my slides didn't have any pictures in them to speak of. So I decided to jazz it up a little bit at the front of the talk. And so the first obvious thing to do is to trot out this old picture of my cat that I have laying around. But people have seen this before. So I thought what I'd do is give you a two-photo essay. Comparing the two major commercial Linux desktop operating systems via the people that are developing them. So first I have the lead desktop developer at Red Hat, and this is at Guadec in Dublin, and I'm honoring the local culture with whiskey and Guinness. And then we have the vice president of Novell Zimian Business Unit, Matt Friedman. And I'm not sure what he has. I think it's wine and cider. So my assertion is that you should decide which one of the desktops to buy on this basis. But I'm not sure which way the comparison actually goes. I'm going to leave that up to you. I didn't have anything good for Sun, but I figured that the Sun desktop team is actually in Ireland, so you can draw your own conclusions. So I made a slide introducing myself, but Michael's actually done a pretty good job of that already. So I'll just sort of skip over this. Right now I've sort of ended up mostly doing manager stuff, but I'm hoping to get out of that and actually have an... Keith says that I'm doomed. But I actually have an open job position for that, if anybody's feels that are qualified. So the agenda for today. What I want to do is talk about the Linux desktop, and this is going to be a totally shameless collection of my personal opinions on that, although I've been thinking about it for 5 or 6 years, or at least sort of hanging around the people that were thinking about it, so maybe it counts for something. And what I'm going to do is just assume that all of you are members of the Linux desktop development community and that you're interested and what our strategy is and how we're going to proceed in order to succeed versus Microsoft and the other desktops out there. How will the Linux desktop win? What challenges do we have? What do we need to make sure that we do? So if you're not a desktop developer, then maybe you won't be interested, but you know, I figured that you all should be desktop developers, so I might as well talk as if you were. And if you're, I'm going to go over quite a few things that you could get involved in, things you might want to work on. So the first thing, if I'm going to talk about how we're going to succeed on the Linux desktop, I might want to define what success means to me, because not everybody agrees. And before I start just gratuitously saying we every which way, I thought I'd define, you know, what we meant. what does it mean to succeed on the desktop? And this really hasn't, I've had the luxury of this hasn't really changed for me since I got involved. I got involved in about 1997 or so. Initially, I couldn't code my way out of a paper bag. Learned over time. I started out working on Debian, then moved to the work on the GNOME project and some other things. But I actually studied anthropology in school, and I wasn't a computer programmer so much at the time. And I got into this, unlike a lot of people, not from the technology side, but from the side that it was just a really interesting idea, what people were doing with free software, as it was called then, and the term open source came just a little bit later. So my goal, I really just thought it was a really exciting thing to make this open source software something that anybody could use. You know, back in the day, it was all, you know, I got involved in it using Emacs and the command line and tech and whatever. I used to write my papers with it. But, you know, most of the people that I was going to school with couldn't use it. So to me, it was interesting to broaden the audience and the number of people that could successfully use free software. And that's really has continued to be what I'm trying to achieve on a daily basis. And so, you know, what I want to talk about today a little bit is how to achieve that goal. And I think it's perhaps it's an interesting goal, even if you don't agree with it. Is there a clock in here, by the way? Because otherwise I'm going to get way off skew. I don't know. If somebody could find me a watch, that would probably be a good idea. Because otherwise you'll be here for 3 hours. So, thank you, Michael. When am I supposed to finish? Eleven thirty. Okay, great. Perfect. So, why the desktop? Why do we have to do the desktop at all? Can't we just leave that to Microsoft and just do the server? You know, that's sort of the first question. And I just talked about that a little bit, you know. It's because we want to have more people able to use the operating system. But it's important to remember as well that if we don't do the desktop, the server is a non-starter. And you can see that this has happened to other companies in the past. They tried to stick only to the server. Well, guess what? Microsoft owns the desktop. They want to own the server as well. And very soon you find that Windows requires Active Directory and things along those lines. So we're not going to be able to just do the server and just trot happily along. And nobody thinks that that's really a viable thing to do, I don't think. I think it's also, it's pretty fun and challenging to work on the desktop. At least I think that it is. Some people hate user interface programming, but I think it's the only fun programming because you get to see little pictures on the screen and that sort of thing. So the second part of my premise that I went in here, you know, and I'm defining what success is that we should get to more people. We shouldn't just build a, you know, an operating system for geeks. We should broaden the appeal of that and allow more people to use open source software. So the main reason to do that is just that it's the right thing to do. I mean, if we think open source software is a good thing, then we should bring it to more people, make it have a larger impact. You know, let's help more people around the world. But also, it's crucial to the viability of this thing, even for ourselves. Otherwise, Microsoft's going to dictate everything that's going on. You're not going to get support from OEMs and people that make the hardware and people that make the software. And there's not going to be enough other people using the operating system to get the development resources that we want to make it really neat. So I think it is essential that we're continuing to grow and that we're continuing to appeal to more and more segments of computer users out there. We can't just build a desktop only for geeks. Now, you know, we certainly can have a few features that appeal to us and not to others. But it has to have that broad appeal. So why now? You know, why not 3 years ago or, you know, 6 or 7 years ago when I first got involved in the desktop? You know, when I got involved, I was sort of a silly kid just out of school. And, you know, I thought in a couple of years we'd have a whole lot of success and things would be moving really quickly. So, you know, now quite a few years later, it seems like they finally are starting to, you know, the desktop is happening this year, not back when I thought that it would. So why is that? One is that the technology is reaching a lot of maturity milestones. And I'll talk about that a little bit more later, but you're probably familiar with it. Commercial investment in the Linux desktop is finally happening this year. I mean, there's been a few startups and a few other things in the last couple of years, but I think now you're seeing that all of the major companies' interest in Linux are getting interested in this. It'll be this year or next year at the latest for most of them. And of course, that's driven by strong customer interest. You know, when you start to get people that actually do have money to spend calling up the executives and saying, I want to buy, you know, some large number of desktops, and that's when things start to happen. We also have some deployments that have already happened in government and education primarily around the world, and you've probably heard of those. State in Brazil, this huge China success that Sun Microsystems has had. 80,000 desktops in the Extremadura region of Spain. Lots of universities you know, in the United States, such as MIT. So those people are providing feedback loops. We're seeing what works and what doesn't. We're iterating the technology, and it's getting better. We have a pretty cute window of opportunity right now with Longhorn being delayed. So we have a couple of years where Microsoft just doesn't really have anything new. It's still Windows XP. And I think we've, you know, very close to catching up to Windows XP in a technical sense, which puts us in a nice position. So I'm sure everybody's read these magazine articles, Is Linux Ready for the Desktop? I feel like this has been the constant through, you know, all the years that I've been working on Linux, right? Are these magazine articles, and they seem to come out once per month or something like that. And, you know, they can have the yes it is or the no it isn't view, but they're all essentially the same silly article, in my opinion, because it's not really a meaningful question. You really have to ask something much more precise in order to be able to discuss it in any sense that matters. But my answer to it is that, yeah, we absolutely are. I mean, a lot of people are using Linux on the desktop successfully now. The Google statistics are you know, not huge percentage-wise, but almost 2% of the users searching on Google are using Linux. And that comes out to a lot of people, really, in absolute terms, if you look at it. And of course, these large deployments that we've heard about in, you know, all around the world. And all of you, I'm hoping. Maybe not everyone. There's always the OS X defectors. So, and of course, we harangue them mercilessly on the GNOME IRC channel. So, in 3 years, of course, we'll be even more ready for the desktop, ready for more desktops. A lot of things will be improved, and if we're smart about it, then those things will be improved in a way that we appeal to more and more possible desktop users. And of course, we'll never really be ready for the desktop, right? There's always going to be something that's not quite good enough, or that could be better, or that would let us appeal to, you know, one more person. I think it's pretty likely there'll always be competition on the desktop, and that someone other than Linux will be offering something. I mean, you know, we may completely crush Microsoft, but it could take a few years. I'm optimistic. So here are some improved questions to think about. One is how we get the next increment of desktop market share. I think that's really the smart way to think about it. You know, what's the next thing that we need to do to grow just a little bit? And to me right now, that's the, what you might call the corporate desktop. And that's the one that's managed, that has a system administrator, and where they sort of want to lock things down and control things and keep people from, you know, messing things up essentially and causing a lot of support headaches. So that's the easiest thing for us right now, and I think is where the next increment will come. And going along with that, how will we enable, you know, the next class of users to use the Linux desktop? What are the barriers to that right now? And talk a little bit about that over the course of the hour. I'm really interested in when we're going to reach these different market share milestones. The interesting thing about that is that, you know, at what point when reaching those does the Linux desktop become something that's sort of default addressed by the websites out there, the ISVs out there, the OEMs out there, right? When do they have to start to care, essentially? And when do we pass Apple? That'll be a huge change, something that, you know, Apple's been the second player to Microsoft for quite a long time, as long as I can remember in the desktop space. And finally, something sort of the second half of the hour, what I want to talk about today is how can we not only be ready for the desktop, how are we going to proactively be better and compete versus the Microsofts of the world? So just, we have to have the right expectations in terms of timing. Because, you know, when I got involved in the Linux desktop, I didn't, and, you know, it's just sort of kept going on. Is this going to be the year? Is this going to be the year? So this is, I mean, look how long Linux development has been going on, and open source development in general. It's just a really long time. I mean, you feel like, at least to me, I feel like the computer industry is something that moves really quickly, but at the same time, there's always these amazingly long time frames between the major things happening. So. It's been a long time. We've done a lot of work. And the server has taken quite a few years to catch on, although people seem to feel that's almost assured at this point. We have a little bit of an edge on the desktop front because the server has already happened, right? And so the same companies, they've already heard the word Linux. They've already, you know, built up a support organization. There's already businesses. There's already business models. There's already relationships between different businesses and between customers. So the server's prime the desktop. Potentially it moves surprisingly faster than Linux on the server did. But still it will take time. I mean, just customer evaluation cycles is normally a matter of months. So is there a single moment we can say we've succeeded? The one to me, you know, when I'm going to know that I've succeeded is when I go to my bank website and they've actually tested the thing with my Linux web browser, right? When people have to care about the Linux desktop as a significant user base and they can't just write things for Microsoft Windows. Because I think that's when we're really going to have brought a lot of the benefits to the world and when there's going to be broad awareness of the Linux desktop. So to me, if we can point out a single point in time where the Linux desktop has succeeded, that's going to be it. But another question to think about is where the desktop will stand technically and adoption-wise when Longhorn comes out. I mean, that's the competition. Overall, software development isn't something that ends, so we can't say, you know, how long will it take is really kind of a dumb question. But it doesn't stop me from putting it on my slide. So I want to talk a little bit, again, before the bulk of this talk is talking about the Linux desktop itself, but before I dive into that, I want to talk about what are some of the threats that are coming out of Microsoft? What do we need to deal with? Because we need to take these into account as we drive the technical roadmap of Linux. The first thing, this XAML, sounds pretty innocuous when you first read about it. But in Microsoft Longhorn, if you write an application for Longhorn, or you write an application for the web using their APIs, it's the same thing. So a Windows application is a web application. They are the same, and it uses this XAML language, which is totally Windows specific. So if this catches on, it just replaces HTML. and it's entirely Windows specific. So it's something you might want to think about, that they're merging the two application models. You no longer have desktop applications and web applications. And that pretty much makes Windows the web browser. It's a little bit scary in my mind. And you know, it's a concern that people will adopt this thing, because you know, no doubt Microsoft's going to make it as seductive as they can. This is the XAML stuff is a subset of their .NET APIs, and I think we're going to see that fought out versus Java over the coming years. And that's a threat as well, in part because of the next point I have listed here, which is patents. You know, if you go and, I don't recommend you do this, but there's plenty of patents out there if you want to go look for them. And they're potentially quite dangerous to us. There could be features that we simply can't implement for patent reasons. Microsoft's taking every angle they can to grab monopolies, and you know, that's, patent just gives you a free monopoly. Lock-in strategies in every direction. Nobody's a stranger to this. The new Office formats, which have IP issues. The Windows Media, which they're trying to establish as a standard media format. And of course, their network services, including Exchange and Active Directory. So it's hard to say everything that Microsoft's going to do, but we can't underestimate them as a competitor. And I think we need to look at this. And we don't want to be purely reactive to Microsoft in setting our technical roadmap, but we need to make sure that we have some kind of plan, if only advocacy in some areas. So the first thing from here, I've sort of split things into two halves. The first is, what are the challenges and prerequisites that we're going to have to face to even, you know, be a contender on the desktop, right? What are the minimum things that we have to do, and sort of what are the state of those things today? In the second half, I want to talk about what are some areas where we could be better, where we could, you know, actually successfully compete and be better than the other alternatives out there, rather than, you know, just being good enough or just getting ourselves in the door. So this first half is more about barriers, and the second half is more about opportunities. I obviously don't have time to go into a ton of technical detail, but hopefully this will give you kind of an overview of where we stand and what's happening on the Linux desktop. The first one, sort of starting at the bottom, is the graphics subsystem. As Linus said in an interview just a couple days ago, the X Window system is the right basis for this. That's our 2D graphics API, and it's, you know, not realistic to break it. You know, it works fine. It's actually quite reasonable. Fortunately, it's extensible, so we're going to be able to extend that, add to it, make it snazzy and cool, which people are working on. Why is this important? I mean, this just seems like eye candy type of stuff, right? But it turns out to be important. One is just simple credibility. If, you know, if I load something and it looks like TWM compared to whatever the state of the art is, wherever the competition is, then it's not credible. Everybody's just not going to take it seriously, because people really do pay attention to cosmetics. And so we need to make sure, especially when Longhorn comes out, that we're not sitting here looking like TWM or Windows 95 or something like that. What'd you say? Oh, yeah. Well, you know. TWM may rock, but it's ugly. It's hard to argue with that. So, anyway, I've often thought of implementing TWM emulation mode in Metaspy, but then decided I had more time. You know, I needed that time for something more productive. Anyway, it'll happen someday. Just on the usability front, graphics can be really important too, because you want to do things like have smooth, you know, if something's moving around the screen, it's better if there's a smooth transition, because then people can see what happened and they don't get confused by stuff jumping around or whatever it may be. And there's features that just flatly require better graphics, obviously, like displaying video or whatever it may be. There's a lot of challenges to fixing graphics issues. One is the technical challenges. I'm not worried about that. Open source always seems to have this stuff well in hand. But it does take time. Organizational challenges are a little bit more scary. The X community has a little bit of historical baggage going on, needs some work, and is in this strange situation of sort of being sandwiched between the kernel developers and the desktop developers, which isn't something that can be very much. The political challenges are always the scariest ones to me, because these are the ones that are the hardest to deal with. You know, they don't rely solely on us. We need to make sure we can actually write drivers for the important video cards out there. And so, you know, as you're working on your software, don't neglect to also send letters to your local lawmakers. But one of the, I guess that there have been other talks here that talked about this a little bit more, but what's happened on X right now is that the essentially all the development except X386 is now on freedesktop.org. So that includes people from X.org, DRI Project, Sigwin, and Keith Packard's efforts. So we have a little bit of center of effort there, and I'd encourage people to join in, because there's sort of a lot of help needed as far as doing all the work for this. Robustness and performance. If you start looking at Linux very critically, I think you'll find that often something gets confused and you end up having to go to the command line to repair it. And that's something that we have to fix. You know, among other overall robustness issues. It's important to understand at a desktop that you can't require people to go to the command line ever. So, you know, if there's any time that you're using the command line, and just try it sometime, just don't use your terminal for a couple of days. You'll find it a little bit frustrating, but it'll really give you an idea of how far we need to go, especially when there's sort of an error case. There's an unfortunate number of times that there's an error and the program just sort of like spews something to syslog or, you know, prints something to standard error, and that's just not helpful. What really makes this challenging is that it extends to the kernel. If the kernel has something that the user actually needs to know, then that somehow has to get out of the kernel. We can't just, you know, print K it. It needs to get all the way through to some type of dialogue. And the dialogue can't say something bizarre. It has to actually tell you what it is that you're supposed to do with this information. The alternative is that the software just, and, you know, superior alternative when possible, is that the software just transparently fixes whatever it is, which may not always be possible. But really, in any case where there's something that is an actual problem that needs addressing by the user, it needs to either be in the UI or it needs to get transparently fixed, and if not, it's a bug. So if you start to think about that, that's a pretty significant technical challenge that we need to overcome. And it's a hard one because it spans multiple open source projects. It's sort of a general observation I think you'll see throughout this talk, is that the hardest problems are the ones that span multiple open source projects, because then you have to get, you know, people that don't know each other to talk to each other and sort out how to fix it, and they kind of, you know, pass the buck around with, you know, user space versus kernel space is the classic example, but, you know, it happens between every two projects where it could potentially be done in either one. And we need to make sure that as a community we're mixing with people working on other things so we can start to address this type of issue. We're going to have to introduce performance metrics on the desktop to be able to track performance. And this isn't just, well, you know, this feels faster, this feels slower, or, you know, I rebuilt everything with, you know, ridiculous GCC options that don't even exist, and, you know, now it feels faster to me, or whatever it may be. We have to have real metrics for specific things where they're actually timed And we need to track those and make sure that they don't regress. I mean, this is very much what's done for the kernel. You know, when Red Hat goes to ship its kernel, then there's a whole lot of performance regression tests that run. And if some particular operation has become slower, then that's a problem, because if you ship the kernel to a customer and suddenly it's three times as slow, then it's just really embarrassing, basically. So we need to be sure that we're avoiding regressions in the same way on the desktop. And that's not really done right now. So I think that's something that's very likely to be added by commercial contributors. But as far as actually doing the optimization to make sure that the stuff is faster, that's largely been developers all over the map. So a huge barrier that people face when they're moving to Linux desktops, probably the largest barrier, is the issue of the migration path interoperability. You can't just take your company and convert it to Linux one day, you know, every single machine, and move every service and, you know, every kind of user and every, it's just not going to happen. And we have to realize that realistically. So that means you need to be able to take Linux machines and introduce them on the client side while keeping Microsoft or some other Unix or whatever it may be on the server. You have to be able to do the reverse. You have to be able to take Linux servers and introduce them while they're still Windows clients. You have to be able to work with Microsoft file formats. I mean, I think that's pretty obvious. That's sort of widely accepted as the number one important thing for the desktop, is to handle Word documents. But we also need to work with all the web pages out there. Mozilla seems to be pretty good these days, but there's still some things that it will get confused by. And that's obviously not going to be something, you know, that's not a battle with an end. That's sort of like the ongoing tracking all the web standards and whatever IE is up to. So, you know, this is going to be an ongoing challenge, and we have to make sure that the interoperability is there. Some of the most unglamorous, but also some of the most important work that happens as far as being able to do the Linux desktop, because you have to give people a way to transition gradually. There's lots of solutions to run Windows applications, but one thing that's disappointing to me is that most of them are proprietary. So, you know, things like Citrix or VMware and so on. It would be nice to see better open source alternatives in those areas. A lot of customers seem to prefer to lean away from as far as corporate customers, seem to lean away from the Wine approach out of fear that it won't quite work right. And I don't know if that's going to change over time or not. But then that leaves them with only these proprietary options. So I'd like to see some more work in that area. Hardware support, this one's pretty simple. In terms of understanding what the problem is, it's not really simple in terms of solving it. But people are working on it. Robert Love's made a lot of progress in the last few weeks. I think the basic way we get drivers for everything is that you have to get the people building the devices to coordinate the drivers or write the drivers or whatever they need to do as they ship the device. Otherwise, you're just always lagging by 6 months or something, and it's just not really, it's not going to work. I mean, the only way to do it is to get those hardware manufacturers involved. So that's one of the reasons that, you know, we have a chicken and egg issue, right? We have to get a certain amount of market share, and then they care, and then we have the drivers. That means that one of the first places to look for market share, right, is where we don't need quite so many drivers, like we have a controlled standard hardware platform that people can standardize on. But this hardware abstraction layer thing is pretty interesting, and that's Robert Love and David Zuthen are working on it. I encourage you to check that out. And maybe finally, you know, when you plug in your digital camera, something reasonable will happen, like, you know, I'll open a camera application, which will then actually know how to get things off the camera. Anyway, so this is going to be, I think, you know, it's going to take a year or two of hashing out exactly how this should all work to get it really nice. I mean, it's already, you know, I mean, the stuff they have going works pretty well, but could use polish. Related to that, of course, is ISV and OEM support in general. So not just handling random little pieces of hardware like your camera, but just making sure all the latest machines work. People are really, you know, a little bit cautious about jumping right now, but there's, you know, the interest is coming, and that's because the customers are coming. Multimedia. This is one of the scariest pieces, and one that I think the open source community hasn't thought quite enough about. And, you know, as you probably know, Red Hat doesn't ship a lot of this stuff, such as the MP3 codecs. It's just, you know, simply not legal to do so in the United States. And there's no way that we can license because the GPL precludes that. So, you know, if you install by default, you just, you know, can't actually read your various kinds of media files unless you use proprietary software such as RealPlayer. And I think that's likely to be the short-term solution just because there's nothing else out there. But I'm not really, you know, that's not the ideal solution, obviously. So we need to deal with these legal issues. The long-term answer that I think is the right one is to promote open formats such as OGG. And there's a surprising amount of interest in that. You know, I really, you know, on first impression to me, it was like, you know, there's no way, right? You're never going to get those things to succeed. But there actually seem to be a number of people that are interested in promoting them. Windows Media is a serious danger. So again, in terms of just what are the basic prerequisites to play on the desktop, we have to have adequate usability. There have been a number of usability studies that have shown that people train on Linux and they learn it as easily as they do switching to a new version of Microsoft Windows. So there have been some studies on that. And I don't think we have a serious usability problem in that respect. It's already good enough, right? However, I think it's important to have really great usability because people are going to be coming into it with the expectation that it's different from Windows and maybe it's a little bit scary. You know, maybe they don't believe the usability studies. I think we need to be, you know, in your face, really great about the usability that we have. And I think that would be a huge asset to the Linux desktop. Also, it's a matter of corner cases, right? So if you run a study, you're going to test all the typical stuff that people are going to run into. But we need to be consistent about our usability and make sure that, you know, all the different things that might happen to you that you might want to do, you can figure out how to do. And so that comes from process and methodology. It doesn't come from just, you know, one hack one day or one epiphany. It comes from having things set up so that it's going to happen regularly and every, you know, the usability issues are going to get taken care of. So that involves a lot of things. I think the main thing that it involves is a meritocracy, just as we have for developers. You need to have a meritocracy for people that are making user interface recommendations, that are running usability testing, and so on. I mean, this is something you can get a you know, you can get a certification in, you can get a degree in. It is a legitimate area of expertise. And a problem we often have on usability-related discussion lists is that people seem to think that it's some sort of opinion forum where anybody can have a valid opinion. And, you know, I guess that, you know, everyone can have a valid opinion, but at the same time, some of the opinions are more likely to be right than the other ones. because some people, you know, it is something where you can legitimately, there are principles that are well understood, and you can do empirical research and find out the answers. And so it's not something where it should just be a free-for-all. And this is a responsibility that, you know, those of us that are developers, I think, have, is to recognize that there are areas of expertise other than writing software. It's kind of hard, but, you know, it's the price of success, I guess. And we have to remember that we're not writing the software for ourselves, right? I mean, okay, sometimes we are. But ultimately, for the desktop, the user of it isn't going to be somebody that knows C or that's even willing to go to the command line at all. And you know, it's easy to just assume that that person is, has the same priorities that we do, but it's simply not the case. And if you sit down and, you know, watch someone in a usability study, then come to that conclusion pretty quickly. We need to start using reasonable programming languages more often. So, you know, I'm sure someone will disagree, but C and C++ are basically not all that reasonable as programming languages. They make you do too much work yourself. And they're definitely the right language to use in a lot of cases for practical reasons at the moment. But they're a time sink. I mean, you can use another language and get things done more quickly. And there's a whole class of programmers that simply just don't get C and C++. So, you know, they show up on GTK list every day and ask, you know, they ask some really involved question involving a text widget, but you have to just sort of shut them down and say, look, your problem is you don't know what a pointer is, and, you know, you don't understand how to allocate memory. Because, you know, C is quite complex, and a lot of people just aren't going to get it. And C++ is even more complicated, but, you know, at first look, looks slightly simpler. So I'm not sure if that's a pro or a con, but in any case, the whole C++ thing is a bit of a mess. So we can broaden the appeal of the desktop and also make ourselves more efficient. So this has been kind of the motivation. You've seen a lot of noise around the Mono project. I mean, that's why Miguel started it. There's that. There's Java as well. At Red Hat, we're working on open source Java implementation. I encourage you to try out. And of course, all the traditional open source scripting languages. Or, I don't know. It's not PC to call them scripting languages, is it? Open source first class languages that start with P. So, in any case, keeping these things as first-class citizens is a lot of work. You got to keep updating the bindings. They tend to lag behind. I mean, that's why you see the Mono or .NET architecture where they've, you know, everything is automatically language-bound. And maybe we should think about doing something along those lines. In fact, several years ago, Owen and I at Red Hat wrote a paper describing one approach to that, which was sort of the under-engineered solution compared to the .NET runtime approach, but it's something we might think about. And in general, I think we need to raise the priority of making these languages work well. And something that we're going to face in the immediate future, I think, in not only in GNOME but in a number of different projects, is the, you know, the question of Java and C#, and Python, and which one of them are okay to use, and which one of them are we going to build important software in, which relates to clarity of what exactly our development platform is. So, you know, historically, of course, on the desktop, we've had a bit of an issue here with the GNOME KDE split, right? So, do you use GTK or do you use Qt? What are you going to do to build your applications on the desktop? So what we started doing with freedesktop.org is to build a base desktop platform that's kind of the back end for both of those, which means that, you know, GTK and Qt become essentially different APIs to a lot of the same protocols and same file formats and you know, same back ends. So that it becomes a developer question, you know, which API you like, rather than a question that impacts the end user. So that's what we've been trying to do at freedesktop.org. And I think fairly successfully so far, but there's a lot of way to go if we're going to complete that. So, you know, we need to make it clear to people that are coming into Linux, you know, these are the APIs that are supported, these are the file formats that are supported, because it's not just library APIs, it's also things like, you know, where do you install your menu items, where do you install your MIME handlers. GNOME recently moved from you know, .gnome desktop to this tilde, you know, capital D desktop directory for where the desktop is. And, you know, that movement isn't something we're going to be able to do in 2 years, because it's actually an API change, right? It's perfectly reasonable for an application to assume, you know, that it should have, you know, that it should have a save to desktop button, and that the where the desktop is isn't going to move. So a lot of times, I mean, you got to think about this when you're writing your software. Is this something that third parties are going to use? And if so, then you might get stuck with it for a long time, which is a little bit, you know, can be daunting. And things, the pressure to keep things locked down and unchanging is just going to grow and grow and grow over time. And so we have to be ready for that pressure. Some things aren't ready to lock down that way, and we just have to be mature enough to label them as such and say, sorry, we don't have that functionality yet. Because the alternative is to get locked into something that's no good. I think that, you know, at this point we're doing reasonably well because, you know, the basic GUI toolkits or GTK and Qt are both reasonable to use and quite comprehensive. So you can certainly write a Linux desktop application without a lot of stress. A final word of caution, yeah, because I've seen a lot of projects sort of, you know, originally they were an application, then they decided that they were an application development platform, right? It seems to be some sort of inevitable process in the computer world that you have to become a platform. And if you look at companies, you know, they always decide that whatever it is that they're implementing should become a platform. So, you know, keep in mind, a platform is a way to write applications. It's not an end in itself. At least it shouldn't be. So the desktop isn't just this client-side stuff, right? It's not just the GUI. It's the whole network. And this is something that, again, coming back to one of my themes for the talk, it's going to span multiple projects. We're going to have to integrate multiple projects. And we're going to have to start talking more between these different projects. Because that's what Microsoft does. I mean, you know, you have to believe that the Windows client side is coordinated with the Active Directory team and with the Exchange team and so on. There doesn't seem to be a lot of question about that. So to match them, we're going to have to do the same. And, you know, here I just have a list of a bunch of the areas. Directory services, mail, shared calendar is something that would be hugely valuable to everyone, and, you know, it'd be very valuable to me, let's put it that way. But everyone, you know, everyone at Red Hat wants it, essentially, with possible exception of developers who just don't have a lot of meetings. Instant messaging, you know, file, you know, this, the whole deal. There's a whole network infrastructure that we have to put together, and it all has to work seamlessly out of the box as a cohesive unit. And so, you know, lots of times we have these bullet points, you know, like there is, a, you know, Open LDAP exists, right? It's a directory server. But Active Directory isn't just the directory server. It's all these schemas and information that's predetermined that's going to be in the directory server. And then the desktop is going to take advantage of all of that information, right? And that's what we don't have. We just sort of have a directory server and we have a desktop. And if you wanted to, you know, put some stuff there and then change the desktop, take advantage of it, you could, but that's not really... It's not the same thing. It's not giving people an answer for how it should all work and making it work out of the box. It's a little interesting, this whole network thing, in terms of commercial support. So you see a lot of commercial support around the desktop, around the server, and this sort of you know, desktop-related server gets different people lined up behind it. Sometimes it's easier for people to support than the desktop because it's part of the server, right? And Linux is already accepted. Excuse me. It's already accepted on the server. They're already contributing to Linux on the server. You know, there's already a ton of people using Linux as a file server, this type of thing. At the same time, a lot of people have their own proprietary products in these categories. So then you'll see them not supporting these or... you know, trying to be sure that the open source solutions aren't as good, or at least not actively working on them. So you're going to get a little bit of, you know, if you look at companies that are interested in Linux, I think you'll see them separating the client side, the desktop-related server side, and the server side proper, and you know, maybe not supporting all three of them. Okay. So that's all in terms of, you know, that I'm sure you can think of more, but those are some of the highlights, I think, of areas that we just have to address in order to even, you know, begin to play in the desktop world and begin to, well, at least we've already begun to play. You know, as I said, we have almost 2% market share according to Google, and a lot of people are using it, I think, including everyone here. But if we're going to continue to grow and, I think, get to where we'd say, you know, the Linux desktop has succeeded, we have to do those things. But we're not going to be able to just do those things. Those are the things just to be good enough. We also have to do some things to be, you know, better and exciting and different from the other stuff that's out there. So that's the second half of what I want to talk about. So the first thing, the first reason that we're different is that we're shipping open source software, right? I mean, that's the core of the whole thing. I'm assuming if you're at this conference, you're familiar with what open source is. So, you know, I'm not going to extensively enumerate, you know, try to talk you into open source. But this is the one thing that Microsoft can't buy this strategy, right? They're not going to, you know, just go out and buy open source and have acquired it and kill it or something like that. And they can't really do open source because it's not, you know, they don't have a business model built around that. So an important thing, if we realize that open source is one of our key advantages and our key differentiators, then we have to realize also that if we sit down and just make another proprietary operating system that happens to have the Linux kernel behind it, then we're not going to have that advantage. And suddenly we're just Microsoft with a whole heck of a lot less money, which I don't think is going to be successful. So this is, I think, first and foremost, one of our advantages and one of the areas where we can be better. A reason for that is that open source gives more opportunities for more people. It's kind of just, you know, creates a level playing field where lots of people can get involved. There's room for a lot of people to make money or have fun or, you know, whatever it is that they want to do. You can build a business. You can customize things for yourself. There's no vendor lock-in. So, you know, if you're not happy with what you're getting in one place, you can go somewhere else. There's no reason that you can't. And that's something that really stems from the open source nature of the operating system that we're going to offer. And I think, you know, if we have more people, then we have a lot of people that are advocating this thing, that are pulling for it, and that are doing development on it. And that's going to be critical to our success because, you know, that whole huge distributed network of people that are interested in the success of the Linux desktop can genuinely compete with a, you know, a much more centralized, well-funded effort. Internationalization is something we've had a ton of success with open source software and doing better with the Linux desktop than any of the proprietary desktops are. So a lot of regions of the world are just too small, you know, they don't get noticed. But with Linux, they can address that. You know, they can translate it into their language, they can write input methods, they can fix bugs in the applications that turn up in their language. A lot of these languages, you have to rewrite big pieces of the app to make it work because they, you know, the scripts and the input and so on are complicated in various ways. So, you know, we're seeing things like Pango become very generalized and able to support all kinds of different languages. But it's not only technical problems, you know, like doing the translations or fixing the applications that you can solve with uniquely with open source. You can also solve pricing and support problems, right? So if you want a local support provider, then you can have that. If you want somebody that speaks your language, then you can have that. If in the developing world the pricing that's offered is just too expensive, then somebody can offer it for cheaper wherever you live. So, you know, I think this is something that's going to be exceptionally difficult for anyone else to replicate. This is unique to the Linux desktop because it just doesn't make, you know, there's no economical way for a centralized development organization to replicate it. So accessibility is a second one. You know, the ability of disabled people to use the desktop. I think we're going to do better here because we're already doing better than Windows historically has. And, you know, because this is, again, it's something that a small niche market is interested in, but they can go ahead and address their own problems with open source. And, you know, just think about, you know, my slide earlier about, you know, more people are able to get involved in open source, and you have sort of this breadth of participation. And what that causes is that you have lots of little people solving their own problems, but it becomes better for them in some particular way than the proprietary answers out there. And sort of the aggregate of all that adds up to quite a bit of people in different niches that have found something that's a better solution for them. A reason accessibility is important, it sort of, it becomes broader than just the niche of people that actually use it, is that a lot of government regulations around the world, in Europe, Australia, and the United States, in fact, require good accessibility support. The U.S. law goes further and says that you have to buy the best accessibility support that's available. So this can become an important advantage to us in selling to these various government organizations, in addition to people that are going to use the accessibility support directly. So, you know, if you haven't gone to and looked at the different accessibility technologies that are out there and the accessibility projects in GNOME, for example, then I would encourage you to check that out. It's pretty neat, if nothing else. Some of you might have seen the demo at gnome.conf.au. We offer a consistent single platform, right? So, you know, you can take all the same stuff. You can use it on your iPad, you can use it on your desktop machine, your laptop, you can use it on your big server. It's got the same APIs. It's got the same APIs on your PowerPC that you have on your Intel chip. And this really helps minimize costs in a lot of ways for the customer, right, or for the user of Linux, because you know, they only have to train people one time, they only have to port the applications one time, it's just to recompile to go between all these different platforms. Your management tools and basic methodology can be the same for all these different things. And you have a choice of hardware vendors, so if, you know, this chip becomes too expensive, then, you know, it's just, you know, tell the seller of that chip to blow off and go talk to somebody else. So, this again is something, you know, I don't think that you're going to see this out of Microsoft. I think this is something that's going to be only Linux has it. And when new hardware technologies come out, then they're generally adopted very quickly on Linux. Price is the obvious one, right? But I think it's important to understand that this isn't the only, I mean, this isn't what makes open source better. It's not just, you know, it's not just that it's kind of like Windows and it, you know, costs half as much or something like that. There's also a lot of legitimate cost benefits that aren't just saving on the license costs. And there's legitimate benefits aside from cost. But some of the ways other than just the licensing cost that you're going to save money is that, you know, you don't have the client side tied to the server side. You know, if I buy these clients, I don't have to buy the servers from the same vendor and the server software from the same vendor. I don't have to, you know, as I mentioned just on the previous slide, I have my choice of hardware and my choice of CPU architectures. and with open protocols and document formats, right, then I can choose between different pieces of software for, you know, all the different application-specific things that I want to do, right? So if somebody else wants to offer an office suite that opens the, you know, the open OpenOffice.org file format, then great, it's not a problem. So it's, you know, it's very much a matter of, I think, choice is what it comes down to when you look at why is this thing cheaper in the larger picture. Open data formats. This is something that I guess, you know, in theory Microsoft could offer, but I don't think that they will. So it remains a benefit for us. if you think about a few years ahead, you know, if you keep your documents around and you want to be able to access them, then you have to use open formats, or you're just not going to be able to. The stuff is just locked up, and it can only be accessed with a graphical application, which you're not going to be able to, you know, you're not going to be able to write a script to convert that old format to a new format, because it's all locked up in this proprietary format that people don't understand. And that's only going to become worse, you know, as things like encryption and DRM and all this sort of thing get involved. If those come to be widely used, right, then it becomes even more infeasible than before to unpack these closed data formats. So this is something that we need to make people aware of and push it as an advantage of the free software desktop. So here's something that I want to do, that I want to be a neat thing that the Linux desktop offers. And that's, I think we should go ahead and start looking at how can we have open standards that address some of the same problems as WinFS. Now, Bill Gates lists WinFS as the number one interesting feature that Microsoft is coming out with. He thinks it's the most important thing that they're doing. So it might be worth having a look at. The first thing to know about WinFS is it's not a file system. So, you know, it's sort of a data access methodology or API. It's a little bit hard to get at all the things that it does. But among the things that it does, it lets you do search based on the content of your documents. So, you know, if you want to search for a word inside a word processing document, you can do that. It gives you sort of a uniform way to access all your different kinds of data, right? So you have the same API, and you can get at your email, your address book, your different documents, your music library, and so on. And think about it right now. You've got those in different kinds of little databases. You might have your address book database and, you know, whatever iTunes uses to store music, and so on and so forth. But by having a unified API to access all that, then you can build the search. You can also build synchronization of data, right? So if I want to share data with somebody else in my, you know, in a project, or if I want to synchronize between my desktop and my laptop, then I can do that. So these are some of the things that WinFS achieves. And I think it would be a really exciting project for somebody to get started on. And some people have done related things. I listed some of them there. The storage project, which is on GNOME.org. Medusa, which is also built on some old GNOME stuff. Nutch is a web search thing. Yeah, RiserFS. So there's quite a lot of stuff, and I think it would be really interesting to look at whether, you know, can we standardize something, and there's a network protocol aspect to this as well, right, for the synchronization and remoting. Can we standardize something that's an open solution and get that adopted? And I think that would be a compelling advantage for us, because I think it's something that really benefits from being a, you know, an open standard rather than something proprietary. Which, more generally, interoperability and open protocols are an edge that we have, because people do care about this. I mean, I think everyone understands the difference between, you know, I have the bullet point that I adhere to this specification, and, you know, I actually adhere to this specification and care about it, you know, and it's my primary method of you know, having my software work. I mean, there's a real difference there. And with open source, people know that they have the real one and not just the token standards compliance. You know, lots of times you'll see, if you have some proprietary server product, lots of times they have, like, you know, their protocol, and then also you can access it via some open protocol, right? And in open source, we don't have, you know, we don't have some vendor agenda to keep from interoperating with, you know, some other protocol that's not our own, right? It's just all going to work with everything else. So, you know, while we're going to, the open protocol is going to be the favored one in open source, right? We're also going to support whatever other protocols people want to use to connect to their, you know, connect the different pieces of their network. So we're not going to, you know, refuse to support the protocol advocated by vendor A because, you know, we don't want to promote their software. So everything sort of happens in the interests of the user rather than the interests of the particular company. Something I've noticed, though, in the open source world is that lots of times people take, you know, the idea of open protocols a little too far, and, you know, they only want to implement the protocol. I think that's a mistake, because lots of protocols have built in ways to do extensions, right? And I think it's perfectly reasonable to do so. Applications can usually dynamically check whether the extension exists, fall back intelligently if it doesn't. You know, so for example, I've noticed that when I try to access my IMAP email, it's insanely slow. It's apparently due to some limitation in IMAP. I don't even know if IMAP is extensible, but if it is, I think it'd be pretty cool if, you know, Evolution and the open source IMAP servers both spoke an extension that sped that up a little bit. So that I can, you know, get checked for new mail in less than 5 minutes. So, you know, just this kind of thing, because that creates an advantage for open source, right? If everybody's using an open source desktop solution, then they have something that's better than they would get with a proprietary solution. So, you know, while I think we should, you know, we have a real commitment to open standards, at the same time, we shouldn't be afraid to, you know, sort of optimize things where if you're using open source software, then it turns out to be the best answer. Huge advantage for us, and, you know, also a prerequisite, is our developers, right? So, you know, Microsoft has a lot of really snazzy developer tools, and it's very seductive. At the same time, open source has some compelling, unique advantages for developers that I think probably a lot of people here have gotten used to and genuinely appreciate. So, you know, you can find problems in the source code. If the docs aren't there, you can just go read the source code. Not something you want to do, but something that's sure nice to be able to do if you find that you have to do it. You can customize the software, so if it's almost what you need but not quite, you don't have to start from scratch. And if you want things to move in a particular direction, then you can help them move in that particular direction. And I think, you know, anybody that hasn't contributed to open source software, if you do get involved, I think you'll be surprised at your ability to influence what happens, because there really aren't that many people that are making the decisions and pushing things forward. There's a lot of room for people to get involved there. And we have a level playing field for just all kinds of developer technologies, and a lot of these are open source, available for free. You know, everybody's using, you know, MySQL, Postgres, you know, Perl, Python, PHP, any of the million application servers that are out there. You know, there's XML libraries, you know, spell check libraries, there's domain specific stuff, just, you know, everything you can think of, and it's just available out there and ready to use. It's pretty nice. So I think we have some unique advantages in terms of being nice for developers, and especially because that means that we get more people working on our software, that could be a big advantage for us that we should play up. Security. I'm hoping that we can win in the area of security. We'll see how that goes. There's the famous many eyes principle that you know, everybody's familiar with. You know, if you have a lot of people looking at the source code, then it's more likely that bugs will be found. I think that's, you know, very accurate. There's a lot of, you know, you see a lot of security bugs being found every day that get fixed that might not have been found if it was proprietary software. At the same time, we could be more structured about that, right? We could more proactively be saying, you know, we need to look at these particular files or these particular programs on this, you know, on this particular schedule right before release or whatever it might be. And I, you know, I know a lot of commercial vendors have done that, but it would be good to have that sort of, you know, integrated into the upstream release processes, for example. But we do have a multi-user secure system from the start. It's not something that's been backported, and that really shows, I think. It often limits the impact of security issues more than they would be on something like Windows. And we have enhancements in the works, such as SE Linux, right? We're going to try to put that in Fedora Core 2. I think that there's already been a lot of work in that area on Debian. And SE Linux in principle means that a lot of processes can be very constrained in what they can do, and if you do find an exploit in them, then the impact is going to be minimal. So that kind of thing, and more things like that would be great, we should be thinking about. How do we use that for the desktop, though, right? The way the desktop works right now is you have one huge security context. So basically, like, once you get access to the X server, then you can just do everything to the desktop. You can change any process and send any message or make any request, break anything that you want to. It's just one giant security context. Can we subdivide that? You know, and sort of the comparison here is send mail versus postfix, right? The way postfix is designed to be in different modular units. Is that something that we can do for the desktop? And I think that might be an interesting thing to pursue if anybody's looking for a project. Encrypted file systems would be pretty neat. I haven't seen a lot of use of those yet, but if we could make that really easy to install on that and then use it, then I would love to have that on my laptop. Right now, I just have to be really careful that nobody takes it. Also, just because, you know. Anyway. So I think a focus on security would be very smart, because there's already a perception that Linux is better. And I think we've had a lot fewer problems with things like viruses. We should play that up. So manageability, we could be better than Windows here. There's flexibility. You can run Linux in lots of different ways, depending on how you want to do it. So that it's really, you can be totally stateless thin clients, almost stateless with X terminals. You can do a workstation with no local disk. You can do a workstation that has a local disk, but you wipe it every night. You can mount people's home directories over NFS or AFS. There's, you know, directory services, NIST, IMAP, other things short of actually sharing the home directory. Very fine-grained lockdown and control of, you know, what users are allowed to do and exactly, you know, how you want to set that up. And it's an open platform. You know, anybody that wants to offer a management tool can, and most management tools that are out there today, right, already support Linux or are going to. And there's always the command line. You can SSH in and fix the problems. So I think we have the potential to really offer a lot of things in the area of manageability. This is already what a lot of people like about Unix, and we could be better here. So that's somewhere where we actually stand to gain versus just being as good as the competition. So there's a little pet project that Nat Friedman's talked about as well, but we'd kind of like to see in GNOME, is user interface for collaboration. You know, if I want to work with a bunch of other people on a project, you know, have a cool user interface for that where I have shared calendar, I have whiteboarding, file sharing, you know, I'm reading an email from them that I would be able to just click and instant message them or whatever, just all really nicely integrated, where we have a user interface, kind of a groupware type of thing. I think this would be, this is just a great area to do work on in terms of making the desktop, you know, really compellingly more efficient for users to use. And this is something that, you know, I think open source is very well suited to build. It involves a lot of protocols and data formats and so forth. So that's a good one. Michael's leaving. Am I supposed to be done at 11:30 or? 11:30, okay, good. I have 5 minutes. So that's my huge laundry list, and I know I left some stuff out, but you know, I just kind of wanted to give an impression of where we stand, what are the areas that we need to focus on, and I know I don't have a lot of graphics, but I just can't draw, so I just stick to the photos. So just some things to think about. One is more users means more developers. So you have, you know, say our desktop market share grows, right? That's going to mean that we have more developers, because it's simply the way that open source software works. Something you'll notice if you work on an open source project, if you port it to Windows, suddenly you get all these new developers. Like libxml, this happened to. You know, you port it to Windows, and boom, all these developers. Because users, some percentage of them become developers. So that's going to be pretty interesting. It means we potentially pick up the pace of development almost at the same rate that we grow the market share. Although we also have to remember that more users are going to mean more work to do because they're going to have the things that they want. Commercial involvement, I think that's going to grow, and that has positive and negative aspects. And the important thing about it is to manage that well, right? To figure out what the relationship is between the development communities and the commercial organizations, where the lines are, what the rules for how things should work are. And some communities have more experience sorting this out than others. But it's really important to keep the project healthy in the face of this. As sort of speaking from experience, I've seen that go badly and I've seen that go well. At the same time, it's going to be pretty neat to have a lot of new developers working on things. So hopefully a lot of new work going on. Things will move even faster because of that. Longhorn, it's going to be here before you know it. So, you know, we really don't have that much time as far as getting ready to have something that's, you know, that looks really nice in comparison. I think we can do it, though. You know, we have maybe 3 GNOME releases if we continue on our 6-month cycle. Kernel 2.6 is probably the kernel. You know, maybe they'll get 2.8 out, but, you know, by no means guaranteed. OpenOffice will probably just be to the next version, which is 2.0. Could be to 2.2 or something, but probably not. But we need to be thinking about this because, you know, if you're just sitting here cloning Windows XP, which is what I see some parts of the community doing, then, you know, you have Windows XP and Microsoft is already 5 years ahead of that, right? That's not the right approach. You just fall behind. At the same time, you know, we don't want to look at this as cloning XP or Longhorn, right? We need to focus on our strengths, which is why I tried to, you know, list what I think some of those are. Because if we focus on those areas, the ones where we're generally going to be better rather than the areas where we're just going to be, you know, as good, if we focus on those, then that's what really drives people to use Linux. But, you know, even though Longhorn is probably in 2 or 3 years as far as its release, upgrading to it isn't something you just do overnight. It's actually a huge change, changes all the APIs, changes the user interface dramatically. And, you know, 20% of people are still using Windows 98 or earlier, right? Didn't even upgrade to XP. So it's going to be something that's, a, you know, going on over a period of many years, even after Longhorn comes out. And it's, we're going to be offering an alternative upgrade for customers that are moving from versions of Windows. Again, as I've said a couple of times already, you know, open source is the only way that we're going to do this. You know, if anybody makes a proprietary desktop operating system, you know, whatever, it's just not going to catch on. It's not competition for Windows because it's not fundamentally different. You know, you can be good enough, but there's no way that you're going to have enough of an edge over what Microsoft is doing to be able to compete with them. Because, you know, all you could possibly do is spend more of your money on some particular edge. Well, Microsoft can do that too. Whereas open source offers something that they can't copy. It offers advantages that we're the only ones that have. And it offers, you know, just, you know, intrinsic in open source of the choice, the avoidance of vendor lock-in, and the other advantages for people that are using the operating system. If you have something that's half open source and half a bunch of proprietary stuff, then it's proprietary because you don't have the open source advantages. I mean, you can't copy it, you can't move to a different vendor, you're stuck with it. And that includes the components. You know, it's not just the things on the client side. It includes the, you know, your whole desktop solution. So, you know, I hate to keep repeating that, but that's what I really think is critical for us to succeed. So, you know, just wrapping up, you know, I think we should aim high. I think we should try to essentially become a huge desktop player. Linux desktop should succeed and should get a lot of market share. But this is going to be something that's already gone on for many years. It will continue to go on for many years. Huge potential benefits. But it's not guaranteed. know, you have to go into it saying, you know, we're going to work really hard and we're going to try to make it work, and if we do, then we'll succeed, but if we don't, then we won't. Individuals, again, you can have a giant impact on what goes on. It's important to realize that even the biggest projects like GNOME and KDE have a relatively small core of developers that are driving, you know, all the direction of the technology and what happens. So, you know, if you get involved with that, you can really be critical in determining, you know, which of the many things I listed gets focused on, or whether it's something else, you know, what our strategy is. And I hope you'll think of yourself as part of, you know, this group that's trying to achieve, you know, try to make the Linux desktop succeed, and not just think of yourself as a bystander, because even if you can't code, there's all sorts of things that need to be done. I mean, from testing and bugs to documentation, translation, everything. I mean, there's just a lot of different kinds of ways that you can contribute, or just, you know, just advocacy and helping other people use the desktop. So, you know, I'm pretty excited about this. I'm not the sort of person that, you know, I'm not Miguel. I don't bounce off the walls exactly. But, you know, I've spent a huge chunk of my admittedly short life working on this kind of thing. And so, you know, I'm excited. This is the year, I think. I have my hopes up. So, all right. It's 11:30.